Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. As a conservative, it pains me to say it, but the fact is that I see a disturbing degree of right-wing anti-Semitism on social media, coalescing around a growing handful of so-called conservative influencers who I believe are exploiting that ugly bigotry to amass followers and clicks and to foster division on the right, and it's working. For example, the phrase, "Christ is King," is now being weaponized by right-wing bigots as a sort of litmus test to identify which Christian conservatives side with them, thus isolating those Christian conservatives like, say, the Daily Wire's Andrew Klavan and Jeremy Boring, who recognize that the phrase is being appropriated by anti-Semites and who are calling them out for it. I'm a Christian conservative. I believe Christ is King, but I've never been especially wild about that phrase because I believe it does not fully capture Christ's glory and stature. I believe Christ is the King of Kings. I prefer Christ is Lord, not only because he literally is God, but because Lord suggests an ultimate ruler above mere kings. That marks me in the eyes of right-wing anti-Semites as someone who is not one of them, and they make no bones about viewing those like me as an enemy sympathizer. I think all this has been empowered by the surging, violent left-wing anti-Semitism we've seen all over the world in the wake of the Hamas attacks in Israel of October 7th, 2023. The radical Jew haters on the left have given cover to and enabled a surge of right-wing bigots online, and I think that's more than a shame. It's a threat that must be confronted. I don't think it can be stamped out, because anti-Semitism is never going to be stamped out, but it's something conservatives must not hesitate to denounce and push back against. It's unchristian and anti-conservative to assign collective blame or guilt or sin to any one demographic. Anti-Semitism on the left is a function of their identity politics, which categorizes everyone and everything in terms of the Marxist paradigm of oppressor versus oppressed. Israel, by virtue of its conflict with the Arab population that calls itself Palestinian, is, by this paradigm, categorized as a white oppressor, a settler colonialist state that is purportedly waging genocide against quote-unquote brown people. This is all an ugly lie, of course, but it is a lie that carries massive social and political weight among the left-wing elites all around the world who control the cultural arenas of the news media, education, and entertainment. Why are we witnessing this surge of Jew hatred on college campuses and in the streets of major cities worldwide? What are the roots of this Jew hatred, and how has it been sustained over the course of millennia? Why is it so shot through with blood libels and conspiracies like Jews running the world? What is the truth about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? My guest today can enlighten us on all of this and more. He's the author of a new must-read history of anti-Semitism, which I just finished reading, and I assure you it's not only top-notch scholarship, but highly readable as well. You owe it to yourself to check out our upcoming conversation and to get this book straight away and get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about the roots and fruits of Jew hatred, Christian anti-Semitism through the centuries, the Nazi and Islamic alliance against Jews, conspiracy theories and Holocaust denial, and Israel and the so-called Palestinians. So stay with us here at the intersection of politics and culture because you do not want to miss this interview. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the other important conversations we are having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Don't touch that dial. Guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is an astoundingly accomplished author, scholar, thinker. He's a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the director of the essential website Jihad Watch, the author of, I think, 30 books now, ranging from political commentary to history to theology to biography, not to mention his prolific daily commentary at the Freedom Center's website, Front Page Mag, and also PJ Media. A true scholar and a gentleman, Robert Spencer, welcome to the Right Take podcast again.
Always good to talk to you, Mark. Thank you.
My pleasure, believe me. Robert, the last time you were on, we talked about your book, Muhammad, A Critical Biography. That was just about 4 months ago. And now you have released a brand new one called Anti-Semitism, History and Myth, about which Dennis Prager, a pretty serious authority on the subject, has said, quote, "I do not believe a more important book on anti-Semitism has ever been written," unquote. That is high praise. I've read the book, and I completely agree, but I might add that a timelier book on anti-Semitism has never been written. Robert, ever since the Hamas attack in Israel a year and a half ago, when you would think that the world would come together in sympathy with the victims and to condemn the barbaric war crimes that were committed on October 7th, 2023, the world has witnessed an absolute tsunami of murderous Jew hatred sweeping through major cities around the world. In the book, you call it the return of an ancient evil. Why is it surging again?
Well, I think that it's not an organic thing, Mark. It's a byproduct of a concerted campaign that is being undertaken by some wealthy interests. The evidence for that is all around us. One of the indications of that is that, of course, we saw on campuses all over the country these demonstrations in favor of Hamas, including the notorious encampments featuring people camping out on their various campuses in protest against Israel's actions in Gaza. And what was noteworthy about the encampments on many of these university campuses is that everybody had the same tent. And so it wasn't as if these kids just decided to go out and camp out on campus and used whatever equipment they had at hand. They were supplied these tents in order to carry out these demonstrations. And, well, that was just one indication that this was astroturfed and not an organic protest.
You write at the beginning of the book that you are not Israeli or Jewish. So what compelled you to write it?
I was actually kind of shocked after October 7th that I assumed that people that I admired, people that I had worked with in various contexts, people whom I thought were sensible, were going to be appalled at the Hamas jihad attack and supportive of Israel's measures for self-defense. And I was shocked, actually, without any exaggeration, quite shocked to discover that at least two of the people that I had admired and worked with in the past, a former writer for Jihad Watch was one of them, they were not only not supportive of Israel, but were actively sending me all this incredibly anti-Semitic material, writings by the leftist Marxist ideologue Max Blumenthal, ancient anti-Semitic rumors and conspiracy theories and so on. And I thought, this is astonishing. I thought these things were dead and buried, or that such people were discredited, at least among patriots. And so I thought, well, if that's not the case, then I'm going to have to try to address this. And that's what the book is designed to do.
Well, there's so much crucial information in the book that needs to be shared. I hardly know where to begin. So let's just start with the beginning. Let's start with the origins of anti-Semitism. You lay out four principal sources for it. And I don't want you to have to give away too much about the book, too many spoilers, but maybe you could elaborate a little on a couple of those principal sources.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's Christianity, Islam, National Socialism, which is Nazism, and International Socialism, which is Communism. And a lot of people will say, wait a minute, Christianity? And that's a perfectly reasonable caveat, because after all, Christianity is the only one of the four that has repudiated anti-Semitism and rejected it as a valid Christian option. Nonetheless, Christian anti-Semitism has a long and sorry history, which I sketch out in the book. And unfortunately, nowadays, it has become the rallying point for a lot of the contemporary people who are expressing these ancient anti-Semitic themes, notably people like Candace Owens, whose dispute with the Daily Wire was touched off when she was arguing with Ben Shapiro about Israel's actions in Gaza very early on after October 7th. And then she posted "Christ is King," and "Christ is King" became a rallying cry for a lot of these people who were telling these lies about Jews. Obviously, it's not necessarily that kind, an anti-Semitic statement, as they have claimed now, you know, that the defenders of Israel are saying that even to say Christ is King is anti-Semitic. Well, that's just propaganda and hysteria. But the fact is that the statement has been and is being used as a kind of a dog whistle for the anti-Semites.
Yeah, in fact, you anticipated a question of mine, so I'm just going to jump right to it. As much as I hate to say it, as you noted, the right has an anti-Semitism problem, too. It's not just the left's open Jew hatred that you see in the streets and on the college campuses, as you referred to. I think this left-wing Jew hatred has actually empowered the online surge of right-wing anti-Semitism that you see, which is being amplified by some social media influencers like Candace Owens, as you noted, Andrew Tate, who rightly or wrongly is considered right-leaning, a few others I could name. What can conservatives, and especially maybe Christian conservatives, do to discredit or marginalize and distance themselves from right-wing anti-Semitism?
Well, I think the major thing we have to do is not be afraid to speak out about it. And the fear is indeed pervasive, because when you have somebody like Tucker Carlson, somebody of that stature and magnitude on the contemporary scene, platforming a crackpot pro-Nazi pseudo-historian such as Daryl Cooper, then a lot of people on the right, they think, well, my goodness, I don't want to throw Tucker Carlson under the bus. He's hanging out with Trump, and he's very well connected, and he's very powerful, and I don't want to give ammunition to the opposition. And that's perfectly reasonable on the face of it. On the other hand, Tucker Carlson is increasingly becoming a liability for Trump and a direct contradiction to Trump's forthrightly and unapologetically pro-Israel policies. And consequently, we have to not be afraid to say Tucker's gone mad on this. And there's no justification for giving so much air to this historian who actually is repeating Hitler's talking points from World War II and portraying Churchill as the villain of the times. This is just sowing incredible confusion and discord. And so, you know, Tucker Carlson isn't infallible or perfect, and he has to be called out on this.
Yes, I agree. What a disappointment Tucker has become, I'm afraid to say. You mentioned Hitler. Let me jump to another question that you anticipated. Did the Nazis bring anti-Semitism to the Islamic world, as some scholars would argue, or has it always been endemic to Islam?
Yeah, that's a very important point, Mark, because years ago, actually, I debated the German scholar Matthias Kunzel on this, and he's still out there. It's kind of amazing, because during our debate, he backtracked and acknowledged that Islamic anti-Semitism had a firm basis in the Quran and in Islamic tradition. But actually, he has published and asserted many times, and he's still out there doing it to this day, that the Nazis brought anti-Semitism into the Islamic world, that it's not really organic or intrinsic to Islam. And that is flatly false and based really on an ignorance of what the Quran says in regard to the Jews. And it's astonishing, somebody who reads the Quran attentively and with an eye toward what Islamic tradition says, will see that the Quran actually is deeply anti-Semitic, always portrays the Jews as villains, as enemies of Allah, and opponents of the Muslims. The life of Muhammad, it's the same thing all the way through, and Islamic tradition is unanimously anti-Semitic, and in a departure from, or a distinction from, Christian tradition, actually never has rejected or reformed the anti-Semitic teachings. And so Islam is actually more dangerous for Jews than Christianity, as is evidenced by the fact that even at the beginning of the 20th century, most Jews lived, 17 million lived in Europe among the Christians and 1 million in the Islamic world among the Muslims. Obviously, this is not to minimize Christian anti-Semitism or to ignore the fact that the Holocaust followed that, but the reality is nonetheless that Islam is deeply anti-Semitic, and we ignore that at our own peril.
Let me jump back to talk a little bit about ancient history. You write in the book that certain paradigms of Jew hatred were established in the ancient world. For example, Jews were accused by the Roman authorities of dual loyalty for maintaining their distinct identity and not fully assimilating into the mainstream society. But that's a paradigm we still see operating even today, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of wild how much a lot of the things that are going around among the so-called Groypers, I'm not sure I'm saying that right, but anyway, you know, Nick Fuentes and his crowd and Candace and all that, a lot of the things they're saying, which people think are so cutting edge and daring in breaking from the norms that have prevailed over the last few decades, they're actually just ancient anti-Semitic themes that go back to, as you noted, to before Christianity in the Roman Empire. And it's wild that there are things in the Roman sources, pre-Christian sources, about how the Jews carry out these terrible rituals and do these terrible things in the temple that violate the stated tenets of Judaism. And this is something that we still hear nowadays, although of course there's no temple nowadays. The idea remains that they have these terrible secret teachings or secret practices that contradict what they state on the surface. And well, the thing is that if you're speaking out publicly and contradicting what you were doing privately, then this is going to come out within the community at some point. And of course it never has in Judaism, because these statements are false. And so it's wild that as false as they are nonetheless circulating yet again as if they were new.
Yeah, and can you explain how the early Jewish and Christian communities, which were initially two factions of the same community, how did they begin to grow apart and become increasingly antagonistic with each other?
Well, what's astonishing is that as late as the 4th century, when Christianity was spreading very quickly in the Roman Empire, the Jews and Christians in many areas had very close and friendly relations. And what's unfortunate about what happened then is that the leading Christian authorities began to denounce the Jews in such lurid terms that there came to be tremendous antagonism against, or that is, between the two groups. And notable among this is St. John Chrysostom, who is a towering figure in early Christian history and is revered as a saint and a father of the church, very important figure among both Orthodox Christians and Roman Catholics. And St. John Chrysostom, of course, did many great things and has many wise teachings, but he said in very stern language that he actually even said, "I hate the Jews," which of course you would think is in complete contradiction to his own creed. And he denounced the synagogue, said all sorts of horrible things were going on in there. He said that even if the Jewish doctors were healing the Christians, that the Christians should not trust them and shouldn't go to them. And I thought that in itself is telling, that it's not as if people were going to the Jewish doctors and getting sick, which might have been some reason for Chrysostom to be denouncing the Jews in such strong language. But he has to acknowledge that the people were getting better. And even though that was the case, he says you must not hang out, you must not go to them or spend any time among the Jews. And this, of course, was one of the early linchpins for this lasting antagonism that grew up between the two.
it wasn't just the early church or the Catholic Church down through the centuries, because when the Reformation came along in the 16th century, and Martin Luther revealed himself to be not exactly a great friend of the Jews also, huh?
Yeah, it's really astonishing. You know, nowadays, of course, you don't hear anything about it, and Luther is a respected figure among Protestant Christians of all denominations, to the degree that you could even say he's a kind of saint if they had saints. And yet, if you read what Martin Luther wrote about the Jews, it is incredibly virulent and intemperate, and is just the kind of language, the kind of violent language that leads to, you could see why Jewish communities in Europe would be attacked by Lutherans, because they would think that in doing so, they were being righteous. And this has unfortunately been a tendency among Christians. Of course, we have to acknowledge that the Catholic Church, as well as the Lutherans, as well as the Orthodox and many other groups, have repudiated anti-Semitism. And so people who go back to what Luther said and take it as some kind of enduring wisdom, they are out of step with their own traditions. But nonetheless, these writings caused a lot of damage at the time they were written.
Yes, and also, as you note in the book, it laid the groundwork for the rise of Hitler and Nazism and his ability to demonize Jews, didn't it?
Yeah, see, you know, Hitler, it's terrible because Hitler, of course, is really the worst person who ever lived in the popular mind today, and there's a lot of justification for that. And so it is something that is widely contentious. Everybody wants to hang the group that they oppose with the mantle of being like Hitler. And the one aspect of that is that Islamic apologists, who I deal with, of course, quite often, they insist that Hitler was a Christian and point to elements of Hitler's own speeches and writings where he avows the Christian faith. And so it looks like, wow, they've really got a case. Hitler was a Christian. And of course, they ignore the fact that Nazism itself was a rejection of Christianity, that Hitler persecuted the church, and he even said that he wanted to crush Christianity once the war was successfully concluded. Of course, he lost instead, and so he didn't get a chance to do that. But the thing about Hitler and Germany is that whatever Hitler was, even if Nazism was a, or I should say National Socialism was a neo-pagan anti-Christian movement, there's no doubt that Germany was a largely Christian country at the time that Hitler became chancellor. And as a result, there were many people who were professing Christians who were enthusiastic about Hitler and went ahead and joined into the persecution of Jews involved in the Holocaust, and even before the Holocaust began, as the Jews were marginalized and persecuted in Germany. And so it can't be denied that the groundwork for that, for the Christians' willingness, many Christians' willingness to go along with Hitler, the groundwork for that was laid by Martin Luther and other Christian anti-Semites who seemed to give a justification for the idea that the universal obligation of charity just doesn't apply to these Jews, their wickedness being so great that seizing their property, exiling them from the land, even killing them could be justified.
And speaking of the Holocaust, why does Holocaust denial continue to be such a prominent theme among anti-Semites? I mean, the Holocaust is one of the most well-documented incidents in human history. And despite that, Holocaust denial still thrives. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think that it is an enduring thorn in the side of the contemporary anti-Semites because it's very easy and it's completely justified to say, if you keep on with this intemperate rhetoric and keep on blaming the Jews for everything and demonizing the Jews and saying that they're this corrosive, subversive element in society, we have seen now what it leads to. It leads to genocide. And consequently, you're playing an extraordinarily dangerous game. And it's not innocuous, it's not a joke, and it's not just a matter of the freedom of speech. And so the anti-Semites very much want, of course, to take that argument away from their foes. And one of the main ways they can do that is by claiming that the whole thing was a hoax, that it never happened, that it is something that actually the wicked, subversive Jews who are trying to destroy society actually cooked up in order to give a cover for their actions. And so it goes back and forth on that basis.
You cite in the book and explain all the blood libels and conspiracy theories associated with Jews, such as Jews running the world and kidnapping Christian children. Why would so many people worldwide, across so many centuries and even today, as we've talked about, continue to make such claims like these that have no basis in reality? Why have they persisted?
Well, in a certain sense, they become self-perpetuating. That nowadays, you know, for example, you hear nowadays very often, if you go to look on Twitter, X, and look at the anti-Semites, who unfortunately are all over my feed because I wrote this book and in the course of doing research convinced the algorithm that I really wanted to see people saying hateful things about Jews. And so I still get it all the time. And I see people saying, repeating, for example, very frequently, this statement that the Jews have been expelled from 109 countries and we're supposed to believe that it's always the fault of the countries that kicked them out and not of the Jews. Well, that's actually the case, because if you look, and I discuss some of these expulsions in the book, if you look at what was going on, it's invariably that people would start rumors that didn't have any basis, or that Jews were being tortured and forced into false confessions. And then the whole community was expelled on that basis. And then if it happened in one country, it would happen in the next country, and so on. And then nowadays, you have this record that the anti-Semites can use to try to give the impression, well, they must have been up to something. And so it becomes self-perpetuating. But ultimately, it goes back to what I think is the common aspect of what I mentioned before as the four primary sources of anti-Semitism, and that is Christianity, Islam, National Socialism, and International Socialism, that the Jews are irreducible, that the larger community wants them to become part of the community. And the Jews have been the group that doesn't want to assimilate all through history, that the larger community has wanted the Jews to assimilate and lose their distinctive identity and join the larger community all through history. And instead of doing so, the Jews, whatever the larger community was, whether it was Christian or Muslim or Nazi or communist, they didn't want to join it. They wanted to maintain that distinctive identity. And so the people who were the proponents of the larger community began to see them as an enemy. And this has recurred throughout history because people do have a tendency toward assimilation and conglomeration and collectivism. And of course, we know as American patriots that there are limitations to the collective. It's not always a good thing. As a matter of fact, it's often a bad thing. And so we stand against it in defense of individual rights. And in the same way, thus, we stand against anti-Semitism as being also an attempt to force the Jews into the collective, whatever the identity of that collective may be.
Robert, can you address the issue that always comes up in discussions of anti-Semitism and Israel, and that is it anti-Semitic to be anti-Zionist?
Well, of course, it is not anti-Semitic to be anti-Zionist or anti-Israel, but it's a very fine line. Because, for example, when you're talking about anti-Zionism, really, it's very hard. As a matter of fact, I think I need to retract that and say it's not anti-Semitic to criticize Israel, but it is anti-Semitic to be anti-Zionist, because Zionism is merely the idea that the Jews can return to their homeland and live there. And so what's the problem? You know, nobody would say that the Congolese have no right to their homeland, or the Mongolians have no right to their homeland, or any other group. And even if they had not lived there for some time, or most of them had not lived there, because we have to remember that there were actually Jews in the Holy Land all throughout history who never left. And in any case, though, if some of them left and returned, do they not have a right to do that if they are not seizing the land, as is the false claim, but buying it and coming by it on a completely legitimate basis? Then why is it that the Jews only, of all people in the world, don't have a right to their own homeland? And nobody would say that about any other people in the world. And so, yeah, I think that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitic. Also, it's, of course, an endorsement. If you're against Zionism, if you want it destroyed, then you are, whether knowingly or not knowingly, you are endorsing the Islamic Jihad against Israel, which is based on the principle that the Jews have no right to that land because it belongs by right to Islam forever, since Islam ruled it at one time. And that's not a premise I want to endorse. And so I don't think that any non-Muslim should endorse it or is wise to do so. And so it goes back to the things that really Westerners should know better than to get behind, but of course most of them don't know better.
This isn't a question that is specifically about anti-Semitism, but the America First movement, which I generally subscribe to, has a lot of adherents who argue that we should distance ourselves from Israel and the conflict in the Middle East, and that we should end military and financial aid to Israel. But our new president, Donald Trump, is arguably the greatest friend that Israel has ever had in the Oval Office. Do you see in that, and in the appointment of Mike Huckabee as ambassador to Israel, do you see in that hope for the future of Israel and stronger ties between us and Israel?
Yeah, I do see that as hope for the future of Israel. And I want to address the idea that to be America first would mean to repudiate Israel. Of course, this is a very common claim. And the Groypers, so-called, the Nick Fuentes crowd, they insist that it is simply an intrinsic element of their America First principles that they cannot support the U.S.-Israel alliance, and they think that it's wrong. You never see them, however, saying the U.S. should not be allied with Great Britain as part of America First principles, or the U.S. should not be allied with France or Germany or any other U.S. ally. It's only Israel that comes in for this treatment. And you got to wonder, is it wrong for the U.S. to have allies? Obviously, it's not. And they don't think it's wrong for the U.S. to have allies, or they would be objecting to all the other alliances. And so if it's not wrong for the U.S. to have allies, why is it only wrong for the U.S. to be allied with Israel, and only not America first for the U.S. to have this one alliance? It doesn't really make any sense, and it reveals that the America First people are really just Jew haters who don't want America to be allied with Israel, but they don't want America to be allied with Israel because they have this animus toward Jews. They don't have any problem with the other countries because, of course, they're not Jewish countries.
Yeah, I like to say that I believe in America first, but I don't believe in America alone. I think it's important that we actually have allies with whom we have not only economic and civilizational ties, but whom we also support militarily. In the dedication to the book and in your conclusion, you quote the words of Russian dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn about the famous line,
or his famous line about the line which separates good and evil running straight through every human heart. What was it about that quote that you found so important that you put it in the dedication and the conclusion?
I think, Mark, that one of the biggest things that alarmed me after October 7th, in the recrudescence of all this anti-Semitic material, is the idea that the Jews are essentially responsible for all the evil in the world. And that there's been kind of this assumption that has become more and more current that you look hard enough at pretty much any problem and you'll find the Jews behind it. And this is based on, it seems to me, an unspoken assumption that the dividing line between good and evil, of which Solzhenitsyn spoke, actually runs between Jews and non-Jews. And so I wanted to emphasize that in reality, as any Christian should be ready to avow, the dividing line between good and evil runs down every human heart. That is, everyone is capable of sin and evil, and everyone is capable of good. And you cannot say that one group is all evil or all good. This is basic Christianity. And so anybody who professes Christianity, such as Candace Owens or Fuentes, they ought to be affirming this and thus denying the idea that the Jews are some uniquely evil people. But that is, as that has become current in the world again, I thought it necessary to repeat Solzhenitsyn's words.
Great work on this book, Robert. Dare I ask if you are already at work on another one?
Yeah, actually, I'm just finishing it up this morning. I have to send it into the publisher on the 31st of this month, and so I'm finishing it up over these few days, and that's called Holy Hell. Actually, I forgot the subtitle. Let me get it here since you asked. Holy Hell, Islam's Abuse of Women and the Infidels Who Enable It. And that's about the Muslim rape gangs in Britain and other phenomena like that. And that'll be out in November, if all things stay on track. And then I've actually already finished the one that'll be after that. Ordinarily, you'd think they would come out in order, but the publishers thought that this one about the rape gangs would get more interest. So that's coming out in the fall. And then in the spring, we'll have one called The Tragedy of Islam, Failure and Excuses. That one is already finished, and that one is about how Islam is bad for both individuals and societies, makes for societal failure and individual disaster. And that'll be out, as I say, next spring.
Can't wait till both of those come out. I know I joke a lot about how prolific you are, but it's just astonishing to me how much output you are capable of keeping up. Thank God for that. Robert, how can people keep up with you on the internet?
Thanks, Mark. I'm at jihadwatch.org, jihadwatch.org, which is the only online news source for all your jihad news around the world, and at jihadwatchrs on Twitter.
Robert Spencer, thanks again for joining us again at The Right Take, and keep up the great work.
Mark, thanks. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Listeners, do not fail to get a copy of Robert Spencer's latest book, Antisemitism, History and Myth. It is an absolute must-read for getting at the truth of one of the most critical issues of our time, an issue that's often buried under layers of lies and misconceptions. And thank you for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the important conversations we are having here. Remember, if you like what you hear, please leave a positive review. See you next time. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.